This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. And it's the Friday recap, where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll catch up with Hudocs, a streaming service built to present Indiana documentaries. We're joined now by Rocky Walls, Executive Director of Hudocs. Welcome to the program, Rocky.
Thank you so much for having me back, Miriam.
And I'm going to apologize up front. I had a little dental procedure this morning, so my face is still a little bit numb. So if I sound like I'm slurring, that's the reason why.
I did not notice a thing.
Well, we talked to you last September, which was a few months after you launched Hudocs. How have things gone since then?
It's been phenomenal. We've gotten a great reception by both audience, you know, subscribers and filmmakers alike.
And what were you expecting that kind of a response? Has it been more than what you expected?
Yes, I think so. There's two sides to that, I think. One is that just by having some conversations, it didn't take long when we sort of started dreaming up this idea. It didn't take long to realize that there was a huge gap between a group of people in Indiana that love shopping local, they love buying local, they love eating local, and they would love watching more locally produced documentaries, which is what Hudocs, you know, specializes in streaming, but they just have very little, if any, idea where to find them. And so they're on sort of one side of this metaphorical cliff. And then on the other side is all these talented filmmakers in Indiana who spend a lot of their own time and money often producing really incredible stories that often, get posted on Facebook or Vimeo, and a few hundred or thousand people might watch them, and then they just kind of disappear. And so we knew that gap was there, and so we knew there'd be some really positive reception. But on the flip side, the kind of caveat or the downside to it is that, just like anything else, like eating local or shopping local, sometimes it takes a little more effort. And so this isn't the kind of thing where it's like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden it's like, you know, like a new Hollywood movie comes out and just everybody's talking about it and thousands or millions of shares. But we're seeing an organic grassroots growth that's happening that is exactly what we were hoping for.
Yeah. And I think with so much stuff competing for our attention, there's so many hidden gems that we probably wouldn't know of. So probably services like yours are helping to carve that niche out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right in that it really is hidden gems that we're seeing. I pulled up a quote from one of our subscribers on Facebook just because I thought he captured it really well. He posted back in January. This is a subscriber, Robbie Slaughter, who said, "I don't own a time machine, therefore I can't go back in time and subscribe to Hudocs earlier, but I sure wish I could." And I asked him, I commented on the post, and I said, "Well, I'm curious, what's been your takeaway after a few weeks of subscribing?" And he said, "My overall takeaway is there's incredibly good work being done by documentary filmmakers in our own backyard. It's easy to think that high quality production, storytelling, and editing is something that requires huge budgets and can only be done in Hollywood." And that just to me captured the essence of this, that there are so many people who, if they only knew that there were so many dozens and dozens, in fact, of really well-made films that tell really important stories right in our own backyard, I think that they'd want to watch them.
I wonder too, does it open doors or open people's minds in the community to go towards a career like that because they can see it actually happening?
I sure hope so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, because I'm a filmmaker, because I'm in the film industry, I may be more inclined to see news when it's published, but I feel like the only news or the only real heavy media attention that we get in Indiana is usually centered around our lack of tax incentives. And which sort of leads right into this conversation about whether or not a person could truly have a successful career in any kind of filmmaking in Indiana. And I hear often young people, especially, you know, after they finish their school or just want to jump right in with 2 feet into filmmaking, I hear them saying that, you know, folks told them, well, you're going to have to move out to one of the coasts or down to Atlanta. And that's not necessarily the case. I hope that you've got two really incredible filmmakers on the show today. And I hope that that's something that you talk about with both of them.
Yeah, definitely. And so with regards to the lineup for the winter, what does it look like with the topics that you're going to have covered?
Oh, man. Well, so we did decide within our first year here that we would kind of group films as they premiere on WhoDocs into two categories. We have our summer lineup, which is what we launched with, and then our winter lineup, which is presented by Indiana-owned, which is fantastic that sponsors are coming on board to help fund the premieres and the ongoing streaming of these films. One of the things that's most exciting to us is that as we began to create the library and source the library for the summer lineup, when we launched, we, you know, were non-existent at the time. So we were reaching out to filmmakers across the state and asking them basically, hey, can we draw up a license to stream your films on this platform that doesn't exist yet? And in contrast with the winter lineup, with the exception of maybe one or two, every single film was submitted to WhoDocs by filmmakers across Indiana that were interested in having their films on the platform. And so we have a wider range of representation across the state. You actually have on the show today a filmmaker from Bloomington and a filmmaker from way up in northern Indiana. And we have filmmakers from Richmond and filmmakers from southern Indiana represented on the platform. So it's really stretching all across the state, which is fantastic. And topics across the board, too. We have short films. We have feature films. We have ongoing series of stories that are being represented on the platform, which is just fantastic.
So to clarify, you have more than just documentaries on the service?
So that's kind of a fun question. We use the term documentaries relatively loosely because documentary to a lot of people can mean probably a very specific thing. Like they're probably thinking, of the Ken Burns style, maybe historical documentary. Maybe in your mind, even documentary is a specific length. And in fact, documentary just means that we are documenting a real story, or we're telling the history or telling the ongoing story of something that's true and real and happening. And even in that, there can be very experimental types of documentary work. And we have a little bit of that on the platform, too. So really, the only thing we're not featuring is things that have nothing to do with Indiana at all, whether it's, you know, because it's about a place or a person in Indiana or by a Hoosier filmmaker. Secondly, we're not doing feature narrative films, so fictional narrative films. There are lots of places that you can get those, and we really wanted to stay focused on documentary.
And so how do you decide what projects you're going to take on your service?
Yeah, so far we have a submission process where filmmakers can go onto the platform and submit their work that they've completed at this point. We are looking for work that's been completed. And our programming committee just watches those often as they come in, since we're collecting those submissions over the course of months. And then we review those with not a super strict criteria, but a criteria that helps us to make sure we have as broad a representation as possible, and we're covering as many different categories of documentary film as possible. And once again, like reaching geographically and also across racial and gender borders as well, to make sure that we really try put extra effort toward finding stories that are maybe underrepresented.
So it sounds like you're trying to look for other stories as you're getting submissions and stuff. Do you have sort of specific goals around the topics that you want to be covered, or is it just driven by what you get and what people are making?
A little of both. We do have some specific goals. Like I mentioned, putting forth extra effort to represent women filmmakers, which is a category that we have on the platform now, and filmmakers of color. So we are putting forth extra effort to seek and to find those. And then, of course, geographically, again, we started off with our launch being relatively central Indiana focused. And part of that just had to do with the sheer, I think, volume of content being created in the central part of the state. But quickly, we've realized and made connections with folks outside of central Indiana. And so a little bit of extra effort going toward trying to represent those types of films and stories. But we also are largely just looking for filmmakers to submit their work because we're excited by the fact that filmmakers across Indiana have lots of different ideas. And we have been surprised. Sometimes we'll get a title and we'll think, what even is that about? And we're eager to go in and watch and find out. Or what we'll see a title that seems like it might be about a relatively common or relatively well-known topic, and then find out that the filmmaker took a really unique stylistic approach to telling the story. So it is exciting when you sort of open the door to filmmakers across the state who have a really wide range of creative storytelling capabilities.
Well, we have a couple minutes left before we let you go. Can you tell us what the Watch Local Challenge is?
Yeah, so we started off this year in 2022 recognizing something that I alluded to earlier, that in order to be a supporter of all things local, in order to eat local, in order to shop local, sometimes you have to go a little further out of your way. And like you mentioned, Miriam, you brought up the fact that we're constantly bombarded with, you know, noise and constantly bombarded by media. And so we have to, you know, sometimes put forth a little extra effort. You know, me, for example, like my radio, when I get in my car, is always tuned to 90.1. It's the only station that I have programmed on in my car, so that I'm not flipping through stations if I'm not listening to something, streaming or a podcast that's on 90.1. And that's extra effort that I put forth to make sure that I'm listening to WFYI. Same thing with watching local, with Who Docs and local documentaries. We recognize that these things aren't going to pop up in your feed constantly. They're not going to be on your television right when you turn it on, like Netflix or Disney Plus might be. And so we created the Watch Local Challenge, which is 22 tasks, 22 sort of, you can just, there's actually literally a PDF that you can print out and stick on your fridge or by your television that you can check off as you go throughout the year. Simple things like watch a film produced by a Black filmmaker, or watch a film about our waterways in Indiana and learn a little bit more about how you can protect our waterways. Things like that that are very specific and help people activate and really take advantage of their subscription to Who Docs.
Just ahead, we'll learn more about the concept of intergenerational trauma and what steps families can take to heal. A reminder, this show is not live. If you want to reach out to us, find us on Twitter or Facebook at All In Indiana. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we'll learn about the concept of intergenerational trauma and what steps families can take to heal. We're joined by Susana Mariscal, associate professor at Indiana University's School of Social Work and the director of Strengthening Indiana Families. Susana, we were talking about immigrants and sort of the experience of folks that are immigrating and maybe some of the trauma that can be associated with that. I think you mentioned sort of the expectations, and I'm thinking about how you're trying to navigate a culture that, let's say, you're born here into this culture and this is your identity, but your parents have expectations from their own cultural baggage they brought with them. How does that factor into things?
That creates a huge pull in two directions, right? So you're pulled by the culture in which you are participating, which is, you know, your schools, your school, your friends, every other area of your life except your family life, and the family values that your parents are pulling you also to adhere to. So it's really challenging for children of immigrants to navigate those two different expectations. A common thing among, for example, Latinx families is a sleepover. Sleepovers are very common in America, right? And that's something that most children enjoy. But it is really difficult for some children to say, okay, can I have a sleepover? Because that's not something that Latinx families would agree so easily to. You do that with your family, but not with everybody, you know, like not with anybody in the community, like friends and stuff like that. So it's really challenging, because that's the most normal thing. Going out with friends would be like also different expectations. You know, some cultures have these gender stereotypes around what girls can do versus what boys can do. And of course, it is important to change all of those, but there are still those expectations that come from those cultures of origin, and it is really hard to navigate that. That can create a lot of friction and a lot of anxiety also for the younger generations. And it is trying to navigate that. And at the same time, there are very high expectations, right? When we talk about resilience, in terms of the environment, we can do, like, there are three factors that have been identified repeatedly in the literature around what really the environment can do to promote resilience among children. And it's really caring relationships, you know, having that single person, whether it's your family member, whether it's a parent, whether it's a coach, a mentor, a teacher, somebody in your life that makes you feel loved, protected, safe, mm-hmm. and understood. So that person is critical for resilience. The second one is high enough expectations. So when we talk about having those very high unreachable expectations of, I need to be a straight A student, I need to do everything perfect, I need to not have any single mistake, there is way too much pressure that creates a lot of stress, anxiety, and possibly depression in children. Because parents came here, let's say, with an idea of a dream, or this is what we're going to do, and we're doing this for our children, so our children have more opportunities. So those children need to actually take advantage of all those opportunities, and there is a lot of pressure on them to actually succeed and give back to their families after they achieved all those dreams. So it's really, really hard when those high expectations are too high and they're not negotiated with the youth. So when we have expectations and we want our children to develop healthily, it is important to navigate those expectations together. The third one has to do with opportunities for participation and really having a voice and also contribute, you know, in to society, to the community. So those are the three things. But again, I'm going to keep bringing up resilience because when we talk about trauma, many times we see it as we're done, right? Like mm-hmm. we experience trauma, we're going to have to deal with all of the consequences. And it's true. I mean, like, trauma does have very negative consequences, but we also have protective factors that can be activated precisely when we face difficulties, and we can overcome those challenges and actually develop our resilience.
I'm just thinking about so many things that I can relate to with stuff that you were talking about. You know, it's interesting. Earlier you mentioned, I think that these studies were started maybe in the 60s. And mm-hmm. yes. I've only heard about it really spoken about in the last few years as more mm-hmm. of a big topic. And I've right. often felt that some people think it's an excuse that people are using, like, just get over it. Now it's intergenerational. Like, okay, it's enough for you to say that you are stressed or you have anxiety, but now you're going to blame your parents and your grandparents, you know? So what are your thoughts on that?
Actually, understanding that what you're experiencing is intergenerational, more than blaming your parents, brings awareness and understanding of your parents. They did the best they could do with what they had at that moment. I truly believe that all parents are trying their best. You know, that most parents are trying their best, that most parents want the best for their children. So it is when we understand that they had incredibly challenging situations and they still were able to provide for us or care for us, then it is much easier to make amends. It is much easier to heal. You know, it's not that they wanted you to go through this. They didn't know better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can totally see that. And I'm just thinking from my own experience, you know, my father's an immigrant, my mother isn't. So my experience was navigating two different worlds in one household. So it was interesting. And I think, as you mentioned, like when you talk with your siblings, and it's funny because like the younger siblings are like, oh, we got to do anything and everything. I'm like, we weren't allowed to do half this stuff. Like what, where did this split happen?
Yes. Because at some point they basically were like, you know, it seems that when they did this, it wasn't that bad. So it's like they're testing the waters with the first ones, you know, like the first one doesn't get to do anything. The second one gets to do a little, and that's a little bit, it's like they go testing waters. You know, I think that all parents are trying to figure out things, you know, like kids are very challenging. Like kids constantly challenge their parents, right? Like that's their job. Like mm-hmm. whenever you figure out that you can do that, this is what works with this child, it may not work for the other one, and it may not work for the same kid 2 years later. So it's constantly figuring out things. So that's what it was, testing the waters.
Yeah. And I think when you have kids, if you're privileged to be able to have kids, that also is another thing where at least for myself, I feel like I'm hyper aware now, like, am I passing down bad habits? Like, exactly. They're probably going to come back to me, you know, when they're older and tell me like half the stuff I did was wrong. So I'm ready for it.
And the truth is that it's, I feel that, you know, understanding that intergenerational trauma plays a role in the way that we learn how to relate to one another, in the way that we relate to the parents. It's really, in the way that we learn to parent, it's really humbling, right? Because that's exactly what we need to do. It's understanding that we're not going to be perfect. Understanding that perfection is actually a fantasy, right? That we cannot achieve that, and that we're trying our best, and that we're getting all the information that we can, and that we are really as aware as we can be of all the things that we want to change. So it is really, when we navigate the two cultures, for instance, as children of immigrants, it is understanding that we actually have two sets of values that we can choose from. I mean, it's we have more, you know, we have two languages. We have two, like, we navigate two cultures. We are bicultural. So it's fascinating. It's when you see it from a strengths view, you actually get much more, and you get like you, when you realize that you have the ability to choose what you want from the previous generation for your children, it is a very empowering feeling. You get to decide, and you get to say, okay, for example, abuse, violence, that's not going to happen to the next generation. It stops with me. And that is, you know, that commitment, even if you know, you slip, even if there are hiccups, that commitment to transforming the way that the next generations interact, and that we move away from violence, it is a critical one for the healing of the next generation. So it's like, I call it a sacred work, because I feel that it's really much more than just saying, okay, it's a decision that I make. I feel that you are involving a lot of that intergenerational inheritance too. And I feel that to do something like that, you need to sort of bring in not just your strengths, but all the strengths of your family. We don't only inherit violence or trauma. We also inherit strengths, protective factors. We inherit wisdom. We inherit survival stories, empowering stories from prior generations. I heard when I was growing up many times, oh, you come from a family of very strong women. And to me, that has been true all my life. And, you know, I have a grandmother. Well, I have my grandmother passed, but my grandmother was a single mother in the 1930s in Bolivia, like unheard of. You know? So she became a widow, and she decided to do things on her own. And then she remarried, and she didn't wait for the town to approve who she married, you know? So those things, that wisdom of you come from very strong women that get to decide, that get to transform, that get to take leadership. Wow. It get passed down too. So it's also focusing on that too. So I don't know why I was talking about that.
No, that's great. It's all very fascinating to me. And for folks who are listening live right now, if you have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Susana Mariscal, Associate Professor at Indiana University School of Social Work and the Director of Strengthening Indiana Families. And we're talking about the effects of intergenerational trauma. I want to ask you, Susana, how can folks heal from generational trauma on an individual level? I think you gave us some sort of insight, like focusing on maybe sort of the positives and the strength and things like that. is there a difference between healing on an individual level versus on a family level?
I think so. I think that, okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about Encanto in that sense. So there is a huge healing of the whole family in the movie, right? So that involves that connection, talking to each other, helping each other understand what's going on, become much more aware of this inheritance. And at the same time, there is reparation. There is the realization of the prior generations of their behavior, and there is changed behavior, not just intention. So that obviously involves everybody, and it starts as a snowball, right? Like one moves to other, that one connects with other, that one connects. So it actually can create a whole lot of change. But therapy is one of the ways in which you can support this healing individually. But therapy is not enough. And that's something that we need to understand, especially when we talk about minoritized communities that are especially, or that have been systematically exploited, oppressed, that have endured repeated abuse, racism, poverty, lack of access to participation and you know, benefits in the community. So obviously that becomes much more difficult. However, I think that the key to any, so when we talk about trauma and we talk about, for instance, substance use, we talk about violence, we talk about suicide, the key is connection. The key is feeling that caring relationship, that support from the community. So I feel that if we want to really transform the way in which families are interacting and provide support so that not just your family, but other families in the community start healing and start developing better patterns of relationship and communication, we need to start supporting them from a community perspective. So that's really a much more, let's say, a macro approach to this healing, right? It's thinking about families, that all families need that support, that all parents need help at some point. So that's why we need to approach it from a society, like, you know, from a community standpoint, and say, okay, what can we do so that families have the supports and connection they need? And that was, for instance, the response that my project, the Strengthening Indiana Families, is having for in four communities in Indiana, Delaware, Tipton, Grant, and Madison counties. We created family resource centers that are precisely that, you know, a space in which families can be connected and feel supported. And it's like a one-stop shop where they can come and just connect to other parents, connect to resources, just chill, relax, enjoy their children. We have family fun events. You know, it's creating those opportunities for family to strengthen their bond, to build on their protective factors, to reduce the risk factors. So it's like really providing concrete supports, providing childcare, you know, providing other things that families need. And that's a critical need in Indiana. So we're still trying to find ways to improve that too. So.
And that's through, can you repeat again the organization?
It's the Strengthening Indiana Families Project. We are funded by the Federal Children's Bureau. And it is a 5-year project to provide these family resource centers in central Indiana. So we're doing that. We have a model that is based on resilience and protective factors. And we are providing that because that's exactly how, if we want to create transformation in the next generation, if we want to really support parents to be, you know, the best to the best that they can, if we want to transform those patterns of communication and interaction, it is necessary that we bring the community to support families.
Coming up for our final segment of the Friday Recap, we'll hear from the professors behind a popular class at Notre Dame that's been turned into a book about what they call the good life. If you want to reach out to us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday Recap, where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we'll hear from the professors behind a popular class at Notre Dame that's been turned into a book about what they call the Good Life Method. A reminder, this show is not live.
Many of us are searching for a life of peace and happiness, less stress and more contentment. While some people are able to achieve that, there are still many who struggle to find it. But is there a way to get to that place where you're living your best life? We're discussing that today with Notre Dame professors Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko. They recently released a new book called The Good Life Method. Before the break, we started to tackle a little bit about the book and what philosophers you decided to choose to focus on. I guess, Megan, on the flip side, who did you not put in?
I think we have some philosophy colleagues who are probably going to freak out on us having written a big public philosophy book introducing people to the subject and not having any chapters on René Descartes or Immanuel Kant or some of these, like, you know, really heavy hitting figures in the history of philosophy. And it's not because we don't like those guys. I mean, I think Paul and I read like garbage disposals. We read all kinds of philosophy, and we certainly love the ancient history folks or the Enlightenment history folks in that case. But for me, like as Paul mentioned, we tried to pick the philosophers that we're always referencing when we give our own arguments for why we believe certain things. And also, I'm a voracious news reader and news commentator, and the kind of person who always like reads something in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, gets kind of upset, and then posts something on social media about how a philosopher would fix this bad argument. And I think the philosophers that we reference in the book, some of them you've heard of, but some of them, like Iris Murdoch, maybe you didn't know was a really important figure in 20th century virtue ethics. We think they're the kinds of philosophers that if you familiarize yourself with, you're going to start seeing ways that they help you understand all the stories that we're reading in the news right now. And they're the kinds of people that are easily referenced, like having important insights for the situations that we face. And for better or for worse, like some of the really great minds in the history of philosophy don't quite speak into the particular problems we're facing in 2022.
Well, Paul, what do you think is the biggest obstacle in a person's way that keeps them from living a good life? Were you able to find that answer while putting this book together or even while teaching your classes?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that keep us from reflecting seriously, sort of contemplating what's motivating us, what's driving us in life. I think it's totally understandable. I have three kids, and so you know, to set aside even a half hour just to think really seriously about the way that work is playing into my life and how I can arrange that in a way that would sort of make me happy and sort of help my family flourish. I mean, you know, it's difficult, right? It's difficult to find that time. I think too, you know, some of the things that Megan brought up earlier, pressures to live very active lives. I mean, the values that we internalize are often values of productivity and you know, moving quickly and trying to get as much done as we can. I think just finding a way of entering into conversations that allow us to kind of see the assumptions that we're making about where value comes from in our lives, what we think is a good thing, what we think we should be organizing our lives around. Somehow finding a way to break into that, and you know, for me, the way to do that is in conversation with other people and with great thinkers throughout the history of philosophy. That's really what can help us make progress and can help us sort of separate out the things that we're doing just because we think like, well, this is what's expected of us, or, you know, this is what I've got to do to be successful, from the things that we're doing in our life that are really genuinely meaningful that we're going to look back on, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years and think like, I'm so glad I spent time on that, you know? I'd say that's probably, you know, in my view, the biggest challenge.
Each chapter in the book kind of covers a different good life question, like love or work or the role of religion or how to have hard political conversations with your family after the holidays. I find myself like returning to different pieces of advice that we offer based on philosophy that we know at different points. And the one that's been really on my mind this season is the chapter on love, where, you know, we talk about Iris Murdoch and Elizabeth Anscombe and some of these philosophers that really thought that moral philosophy needed more of a place for understanding how important love is in our lives. And the role that questions and paying attention to somebody's mind and their stories is a way directly of loving them rather than giving them gifts or trying to do things for them or change them. And in the chapter, we try to take this, you know, somewhat mystical idea of love that comes to us from these philosophers and make it into concrete habits and practices that we could share with people that we love. And I have found, especially after spending 2 years social distancing from people that I really care about, not being able to see a lot of people that I really care about, coming back again and again to these goals for how I want to love other people in my life more philosophically now that we're entering a new phase. And I think this idea that we can set goals for how we love other people, it's something that's distinctive to philosophy, but it's also answering like a really big need that we have right now. And that can change our lives for sure.
Is the good life synonymous with a moral life?
I'm pitching that one to Paul. It depends on what you mean. It's a little philosophy answer. It depends on what you mean by moral.
Yeah. I think, so to dive just, you know, a little bit into a debate that, I don't know, we could spend hours talking about. This is really a question that Elizabeth Anscombe and other philosophers in the 20th century started asking, because for Aristotle, the good life is the excellent life, right? Aristotle thought we've got a function, we've got a purpose in life, and that is to use reason, to use reflection to organize our lives. And virtues, human excellences, are defined in terms of that. A lot of contemporary philosophers don't think that Aristotle would have distinguished between that kind of life, the good life, and morality or ethics, you know, in the way that we sometimes do. So I think, you know, for the virtue ethicist, those ideas are going to be really close together. I think, depending on your views, now I just want to like mark that this is a contentious position. You might think they come apart. You might think, you know, there's an ideal of the good life, and ethics plays some role in that. But you know, some contemporary philosophers think it's not sort of an overriding role. These things come apart. There are non-moral goods. So I want to mark out that that's contentious. But I side with Aristotle on this debate. I think a good life, a really excellent life, it is sort of a moral life. It's one in which the moral virtues kind of suffuse like your life and direct your action.
In the book, we really hope to introduce readers to this ancient tradition in virtue ethics, which, as Paul mentioned, it's still a controversial tradition within philosophy. And the basic point of the debate about morality is whether you think morality is following a set of abstract rules, like never lie, always donate 10% of your income to the poor, no matter what. If you think of morality in that way, then the good life might oftentimes finds itself at odds with some of those principles, because it might be hard to understand how those principles would apply in somebody's particular circumstances. But the way virtue ethicists think about morality, it's not this fixed or static set of abstract rules or principles, but rather it's the way we try to reason through all of the moral problems that get thrown at us every day. How should we help this particular person who's suffering at our workplace right now? How should we tell whether or not we were being as honest as we could be with our partner? And those reasoning through those really particular questions, there's never going to be any like single abstract principle that's always going to tell you what to do. Instead, it's this process of trying to discern what kind of person you want to be, discerning what you really owe this other person, taking responsibility for the mistakes you make. And so if you think of morality as that kind of process of trying to make yourself into a person that's achieved the good life, that's achieved eudaimonia, then morality just has to be part of the good life.
Is it fair to say that there's no perfect answer? There's no, you can't really come up with a specific, I guess when I'm thinking of the good life and when you're applying philosophy and trying to figure out answers to questions, it's on a case-by-case basis. No two people would have the same answer.
Aristotle has this line that he takes from Solon. It's a little bit depressing. He says, "Count no man happy until he's dead." Like, we won't know whether you've achieved the good life or you got an AA on this journey of trying to achieve eudaimonia, the flourishing happy life, the goal, until you've run your course. That doesn't mean that there's not a goal. It just means that it's not the kind of goal you can give yourself intermediate grades on very effectively, because it's going to depend on how you're fitting together all the different pieces of your life and the kind of person that you're becoming as a result of all this philosophy that you're doing. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a goal. It just means it's the kind of thing that it's really hard in just a one-off conversation. Like if you're, you know, sitting around at New Year's trying to judge how everybody's doing at achieving moral lives, you're not going to have a single answer at one particular moment in time. We do think that there are better and worse ways of approaching all of these questions about what kind of life that you're leading. And philosophy, once you appreciate it, can give you pretty strong advice and pretty general advice about the kinds of decisions you ought to make and the kinds of decisions you ought to avoid. I think maybe one particular example is if you take the philosophy that we introduce in this book seriously, you are going to be missing out substantially on the good life if you only treat other people as like means to your own ends or ways of getting ahead of particular impersonal goals you've set for yourself. That's a bad life for just almost nearly everybody. It's life that we're sometimes tempted to fall into. We might not even realize that that's what we're doing, but philosophy can wake us up to what's going on and also counsel us to stop.
The way I'd put it is, you know, philosophy is not going to give us a formula. Like if you do, you know, X, Y, and Z, then you're going to have the good life. You're going to achieve a good life. It's more like the way in which, you know, different artists can all be incredible, excellent artists in very different ways. It doesn't change the fact that, like, you know, amazing, incredible, excellent art shares some qualities in common. It's just that there are very different ways of realizing that in the world. And I think when it comes to living a good life, something similar applies. There are certainly things that we can say, like Megan's saying, general advice that philosophers can give, kind of an outline that good lives are going to fit within. But the particular decisions and judgments, the ways that one realizes that life, they're going to look very different depending on the individual who's actually doing the living.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have that time to actually think and reflect, because when you're living the busy life and you're on social media and running to work and meetings, you really don't have time to think about any of these things.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're preaching to the choir.
We're also still very much thriving.
Oh yeah. I deactivated all my social media back in like April to see how I would do without it. And it's a very weird world to be in.
I just keep using my Facebook to get into philosophical fights with people. it's like the guy, you know, I feel like Socrates of Facebook. Like I just walk around looking for a conversation or itching for an argument.
Before we wrap up, I am curious about, there's an idea in some religious traditions that we aren't here to live a life of ease, but rather to suffer and deal with whatever comes our way without complaining. How does that fit into the good life method, if at all?
So it's really important, and we start this with the first chapter. There are two different ways we could think about happiness as a goal. One is this, like, you know, experience of feeling happy, the kind that you get when life is going easy and all of your like neurons are firing in the right way and you've just had your first cup of coffee of the day. That's not the kind of happiness that philosophers are setting out as the goal of working on philosophy. Instead, for philosophy, happiness is a kind of achievement. It's becoming a certain kind of person who's developed all of these core human virtues like courage and generosity and justice and love, and has figured it out over the course of a life that they've lived, often probably a life that threw increasing obstacles in their way and had suffering as an important dimension of it. That's to say that I don't think we have to accept this dichotomy that people who care about the truth or are part of a Christian or Jewish or Muslim tradition have to either pick like feeling happy all the time as their goal, and we set that up as the secular ideal, or a life of constant suffering and sacrifice until the next good life begins in the afterlife. There's this middle way that virtue ethics provides, and that's been really important to a lot of these traditions throughout history as well, which is that in this life, we're meant to achieve these certain distinctively human goods. We're meant to work on virtue, and we're meant to overcome obstacles, but also feel more fulfilled as a result. And that is helping us understand in this life and giving us the materials to contemplate in this life all of the good things that might happen in the next. And that's kind of nice. Like, very, you know, in a world where we often get really harsh dilemmas that we have to decide. I think this is an area where virtue ethics says you don't have to make a really awful trade-off. You can have a really important kind of happiness in this life that prepares you for the spiritual life that your religious tradition promises you as well.
What is next for both of you? Is there anything that you're working on?
I'm writing a big nerdy book about love's role in moral philosophy. So if this book was to try to convert all of your listeners and the general public to how important and interesting virtue ethics and philosophy is for their lives, the book that I'm working on right now is trying to convince philosophy professors and other moral philosophers that they should care a lot more about these moral ideas that are part of a lot of our everyday lives, but weirdly enough, don't show up in a lot of research papers or more academic books on the subject. And I'm very interested in trying to make it feel much more urgent in contemporary academic discussions, how important love is in our lives and how that guides our moral thinking.
Yeah. And I guess the projects that I'm working on right now have mostly to do with work in the good life. So I'm teaching a class right now on this idea. And then I'll be starting a program here at Notre Dame aimed at helping students really sort of look, at their life as a whole and start thinking about the ways in which questions, philosophical questions about living well, are really intertwined with these questions about how we work, about the values that we bring to work, about how much of ourselves we give to it. And obviously, these are questions that I think a lot of us are thinking about. So my big project is trying to kind of crack that specific area of the good life and really figure out how we can fit work into a well-lived life.
Thank you so much for joining us. Megan Sullivan is the Wilsey Family Professor of Philosophy at Notre Dame University, and Paul Blaschko is an assistant teaching professor in the Department of Philosophy at Notre Dame University. They're also co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.